So my plan for today is to give you an idea of a notebook. Of course, this was prepared for the talk, but
of what a more or less, for my standards, clean notebook would be. And this is a kind of notebook, a typical notebook that we would use and share between ourselves when doing some research in integrability in ADS-CFT, which will be the topic of the talk, where we have some conjectures, some checks, and we use Mathematica mostly for what were called lunchtime time computation or less, typically a few second computation, high blink computation, and as we will see, so we use Mathematica basically for things that we could in principle do with paper, for things that we in principle could not even check if we were infinitely intelligent, but we would rather check just to be safe that we have the right results. So we use Mathematica very much as an experiment. So before starting showing you the notebook and giving you an idea of the kind of things that we can do, let me just very, very briefly, I prepared this ahead of time, just flash you the kind of keywords, the kind of physics involved in what I'm going to describe. So I chose the problem of studying three-point functions, so correlation functions in gauge theories with a large n limit. So we want to study, say, a correlation function of three operators, for example, O1 up to O3. Each of them is a single trace gauge invariant operator, something like a trace of a product of fields. And we can see each field, like phi1, phi2, phi1, phi1, has a spin up, down, up, up. It's just a question of language. I think of phi1 as spin up, phi2 as spin down. Then a three-point function of these operators in this spin chain language is translated into the following. I have three states. Each of them is a spin chain state, okay, like the ones we saw this morning, with a slight simplification, which I'm going to mention soon. So we have three complicated wave functions, one here, and one here. These are the three operators. And what we are doing is cutting these spin chains and gluing these spin chains. So we pick these quantum states, and we overlap them. We compute expectation values. We cut the chains. Then we overlap pieces of it. And basically, this is, as you see, a combinatorical problem. Given the states, let's cut and glue all these spin chains together. And what we obtain as a solution to this combinatorial problem is a function A, that I called A, of some variables uj. And uj, you can think of these variables uj as momenta of called magnons, which are spin excitations, say this spin down here, moving in the vacuum of the spin up. So we have some function of some variables uj, which I think of momenta of excitations around a ferromagnetic vacuum. So why can we envisage solving this exactly and getting some nice closed expression for this object to the point that, in principle, as I said, if we were intelligent enough, we would not need Mathematica or a computer for anything. So why do we have such high hopes of being able to solve this kind of complicated problem when Lucas was saying that we need these tensor networks and all these computers? And the reason is because in some gauge theories, in the ones that we are studying, there is some remarkable miracle, which is that the spin chains that we find are integrable spin chains. They are exactly solvable, and we can write in closed form what these wave functions are by using the so-called Beaton-Zatz and other techniques from solvable models. So we know exactly these wave functions, and then it's a purely combinatorial problem, although a hard one, to compute this correlation function between these three spin chains. These three spin chains, they have a very interesting classical limit. When you consider very long spin chains with many, many spins, in that case, you can consider configurations where you have many, many spins, and they are changing slowly along the spin chain. So you have some spin chain, and the wavelength of the excitations involved scales like L, and you have some spins changing very slowly along the chain. And in that case, this is described by some classical fields. And in this limit, the operator is dual, by this famous gauge gravity duality, to an object which is a classical string. And this three-point function is then describing a very important process in quantum gravity where strings are merging in space-time. So there is a very big motivation for studying these general three-point functions of spin chains, both for small operators and also for large operators when we are in the context of these classical strings. So okay, so we want to solve this combinatorial problem for the U's, then take the limit when we have many U's distributed along some density and compute what this quantity is in terms of that density. So this was the physics. So let me then state what's the solution to this mathematical problem. So this is mathematics. So this is the solution. This A, the solution to this combinatorial problem of computing the overlap of these spin chains as a function of the momenta of the excitations on my spin chain is given by this function here. So let me explain the notation. So we have some set of variables. We can have, say, 20 magnons. So this can be a function of 20 variables. And this is what it is. It's a function of 20 variables, which is the sum over all ways of splitting those 20 variables into two groups, one group alpha and its complement alpha bar, and then some product of a simple function of the roots in element in the group alpha, and some product over which is an interaction between elements in alpha and in alpha bar. So this is the solution to the spin chain combinatorial problem that we found in the paper cited above with Amit, Colia, and Jorge. So okay, so this is the closed solution for this spin chain problem. So okay, my notebook will start from this formula, but I should say that even to arrive at this formula, mathematics and using a computer was very important. What we did, in fact, was we did part of the derivation, but then we did lots of guesswork. We checked on many small spin chains till we saw some pattern. We guessed the result, and then we checked it on longer and more complicated chains, and it was perfect. Okay, so this is the solution. And I will do two things during this talk in a notebook that I prepared, as I said. So we will check a conjecture that was told to us like a few weeks ago, that Ivan Kostov showed that this combinatorial object can be written as a determinant. And as you will see, this is actually quite useful if you want to study classical limits. Computationally, here you see you have 2 to the n terms, so you have to split elements into two groups, so each element is either in group A or B, so there are 2 to the n choices, whereas here you have a determinant which computationally is much simpler to compute. And then there is another conjecture, which this was present with, was we computed this in our paper, which was important for us to understand this connection with classical strings, which is that when you have many, many roots distributed along according to some density, this A exponentiates, and this is the result. Logarithm of A is a contour integral of a polylogarithm of e to the minus ip, where p is some simple function of the density rho. So let's check these two conjectures from a notebook that we can start from scratch. So let's quit the kernel, it's already restarted. So I want to guide you through what kind of things that we do. So suppose we want to check this conjecture. So you see how we do it in mathematics. So the first line defines this A. So should I zoom in or is it big enough? Okay, so here is A. You see, so I have A depends on 2 numbers, L and M. M will be the number of excitations. And then there is a sum over number of ways of partitioning into 2 groups. This tells you that I do subsets of all, I do subsets and I split into 2 groups. I take group alpha and the complement. And I sum, this is the sum over alpha union with alpha bar. Then I have a product over the elements in alpha and the product over the elements in alpha and in alpha bar. So just with this line, I implement this object A. So I can now run and I can ask what is A for 4, say for length 4 and 4 magnets. And I get this as a solution, okay? So this is what I get if I have 4 excitations on my vacuum. And I could, of course, put more excitations at 7. And I would have a very large output that Mathematica would not show the full output, but I can ask, and I get some big mess. Okay? But this is what it is. This is the solution, the 3-point function as function of the moment of these guys. It's given by this huge animal. Okay. Will I eventually end up? Okay. So this is it. Then we can implement the determinant. So here is the determinant. So we make a table of this very simple form, this ratio of these 2 determinants. And then we can check whether they are the same or not. So we compute the ratio of the determinant over A, say for 4 particles, for example. We get this huge mass. And then we simply ask Mathematica to simplify, and we get 1. So yeah, so this would be an example of some kind of experimental physics where we have some guess for 2 quantities that we believe are the same. Then we check for 4 particles. We don't believe it can be a coincidence. We check for 5 just to be sure. And hopefully it will be 1 as well. And so to simplify is probably not the best choice. I should probably have used factor, which would give the same result, but it would finish in time. So let's see. That I will show you that we will go up to 14. Okay. So for 5, we don't check. we check with 3. It's an independent check. It's not implied by the fact that it worked with 4. But you see, this illustrates already that, of course, we know that these objects are complicated objects. And actually, if I would specify L, it would do it. OK. So this would be step one. So indeed, so we had some conjecture, and it was very easy to check. And now we are certain about all factors of 2 and so on. And this is just a true statement. Now, something we want to do is to check to take this classical limit. So I want to generate some set of variables that are distributed according to some density. So let's take the simplest density, rho of m and x, just a semicircle law, so just a square root. OK, just some density distributed along to some square root. We integrate the density. So the integral from this branch point till point A tells me how many roots there are. And then say I say m equal 40. So here I do m equal 40. I say 40 roots. And I find the root. I integrate from the branch point, which in this case is 2m, up to the point x. And I find the position of these roots. So here is a table of roots. So these roots here, because I solve integrating this density there, are distributed according to this density. So here are 40 roots. Then I could create a plot of these roots and the plot of the density and see that indeed, you see, I just plotted the density and the position of the roots, and the roots are lying perfectly on top of this density. Okay? So I'm just computing everything. There's nothing in the background, so there is just this row, and here I'm just, you see, plotting the density against the points, the midpoint of 2 points, and the inverse of their separation, which is their density. Okay, just to check that I didn't do a mistake with the scaling and so on, so I have some points distributed according to some density. So I'm approaching this formula. Now I can start checking this kind of formula. Okay. So let's move then to using this data. So what do we want to do? We want to create a function, for example, that computes the logarithm of this a for a given number of roots. Okay? So here is the function. So it finds some roots u and then computes the logarithm of a. And it takes the real part because, I mean, for a three-point function, only the absolute value of this guy is really meaningful because you can always multiply each operator by a phase. So we take the absolute value of a and then the log, or the real part at the end is the same. And then we do it for, say, m and l. I choose m and l to be proportional to each other. This is how I reach the classical limit. And I took, as I said, as it I asked, from m equals 4 up to m equals 14. And I asked to monitor m, so to know where it is. So you see m is 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and now 14. And actually, I think 16, it would take longer than the talk. And we could not do 16. And actually, I don't think we did 16. Very good. That will come later. So yeah. So this was actually, when we first wrote the paper, we were not aware of this conjecture. Roughly, this was the data that we could use. So it was up to 14, because we had to use this sum over partitions. So now I have a table. You see the first entry is the length. The second entry is the value of log a. And very nicely, you see, when I divide by l, it is indeed converging to a number, 0.79 or something like that. So I can just check that it is converging. Let's just see a plot. And it is indeed converging, not yet, but we can make a fit to extrapolate and to see where it goes. So let's just ask for a fit. So we make a fit. Here it is. The constant is where the solution is approaching. And then you have the finite time corrections, and we send them to infinity. And we get our numerical prediction. So here is a numerical prediction. OK? So we have some density. We increase the number of roots for a given fixed density. We extrapolate, and we have a prediction for the logarithm of a. And then we go about checking this conjecture. And again, as I said, if we were infinitely intelligent, we would just trust our result, which is that this is an integral of a polylog. But actually, it was a tricky derivation, which involved solving some Ising model. And so of course, it is very interesting to be able to check everything. So OK, so let's compute this object p. So we have to integrate the density over u minus v. This is something that people call normally the resolvent. It's an object which appears a lot, say, in matrix models or in many other contexts. So this is this G. Let me remove the semicolon so that you can see. It's a simple object. This is it. And then we are going to do a contour integral. So what does it mean, the contour integral? I integrate from branch point A to branch point B, and then from B to A in the opposite direction and below the cut, which means that I just change the sign of the square root. So I have a Q that I will integrate above the cut, and then I go to the other side, I just flip square root to minus square root, and I integrate on the other direction. Okay? So I just integrate between the branch point 2 and 4. Now everything is dimensionless, so I can just put m to 1 and l was 3 halves of m to 3 halves, and I just integrate the one above minus the one below between 2 and 4 and ask for 30 digits, say. And this takes a few seconds, and it gives me this number. And now we can, of course, compare. So we have the analytic result, we have the numeric result, and let's see, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 digits of agreement. Okay? So we can compute the difference. And it is 10 to the minus 6. So this just shows that this this guess for the continuum limit was most certainly right, and that indeed log of A is given by this continuum limit expression. So here, as you see, there's some analytics, there is some numerics, but what's great about mathematics is that we can check everything as we go. It's very versatile. We can plot a table, check if it looks like it's converging, make a fit, and change everything, and we don't need to wait for to compile everything. We can really do it as we go. Now, as Collier said, so this is actually what we did when we first studied this object, but now we could check doing exactly the same thing with determinant. So I have exactly the same function, but instead of computing with A, I compute with determinant. And you see that it was choking when getting to 14, and now you see it's going very fast. And it already is at 34, 35, and it's very easily. Now we can compute and just improve our precision. And okay, we can just wait for it to finish, and it will be. Sorry. And it will be 10 to the minus 9. So now we have basically all digits right. Okay, so basically, what could we be doing better? So this illustrates the kind of notebooks that we deal with. Now, what should we do? We could have several densities, different times, different tells, and so on. And of course, this is something that we could do in different computers. I was here computing all these determinants. Of course, this was not very costly. As we saw, it was a question of a few seconds. But of course, I was making a table. And of course, each of these computations could go to a different core or so on. So this would be something that often, with a very good computer, we could gain, say, a factor of 10 or 12, and it could make, of course, a huge difference of productivity. So, for example, this is what we had in our paper. So, exactly what we did indeed use a few cores, and you see what I showed you today was we compute some density, we extrapolate for each value of the densities, and we get one of these dots in this graph, and we did it for several densities, and then here are the analytics and the numerics, and as we saw, they match perfectly. Now, in practice, the way we had to do it was, as I said, using several cores. So say, for example, Collier yesterday, this was a computation that we were doing. This is a check that took, for example, a few hours. So it was running overnight, it took like a few hours. And this is some extrapolation of some finite results into the black dots, and the blue dot is the analytic prediction. So basically this is it. Let me just flash what kind of other things do we also do. We do so-called thermodynamic Bittansatz, which in practice means solving integral equations. Partial differential equations, for example, John and Juan are working on solving some partial differential equations for finding the shape of these classical string solutions, for example. Often we have to manipulate huge expressions, and we have to series expand them, simplify them, massage them. And this is something for which mathematics is also very useful. When we have to do, say, weak contractions or very mechanical and simple stuff in quantum field theory, we also implement it in Mathematica. Recursion relations, like for scattering amplitudes, which allow us to extract components out of and to compute this hard scattering part that I was mentioning. We do some numerology, say, some pattern recognition in this subject of exactly solvable models where we know the result, we will be able to find it. We try to compute for larger and larger sizes, and we try to fix to find some structure and to identify the exact result by experiments. We do algebra manipulations, they transfer matrices, and so on. And as I said, the typical times involved, so it's, we are not speaking about times. I think this is in great contrast with all other talks so far. I'm not speaking about times that will take weeks or months to compute in a laptop. Even in a laptop, it goes from a few seconds to a few minutes, typically 10 minutes, half an hour, 20 minutes. And of course, I mean, sometimes it's not worth parallelizing, but if it were really easy, it could indeed make a huge difference, for, especially for those kind of computations that will take 5-10 minutes. If we could reduce it by a factor of 10, an afternoon could be in typically much more productive. Because that's typically the kind of computations. It's very different. So we are always needing these small computations of 10 minutes, 5 minutes. Typically, we don't prepare some big computation that then we need to send into a cluster. We just need to be always doing these small computations and say these tables and so on. If it were 1 second instead of 10 minutes, we could immediately fix all factors of 2 and pi and just move on. And it would mean a lot in terms of efficiency. So that's it. Thank you.